Hi, my name is Alex, and this is Climate to Action, a California State University San Marcos student podcast. We're here to amplify voices, empower solutions to climate change, and address climate injustice for all living things. We are committed to incorporating discussions on indigenous knowledge in addressing the climate crisis and in providing a call to action in every episode. But first, we'd like to acknowledge that our recording studio is located on the traditional territory of the Luiseno Payam-Cowichan people. CSUSM and its surrounding areas are still home to the six federally recognized bands of the La Jolla, Paula, Palma, Pechanga, Rincon, and Saboba Luiseno Payam-Cowichan people. It's also important to acknowledge that this land remains the shared space among the Kupeño, Kumeyaay, and Ipai peoples. Now, today's episode is focused on the intersections of war, water, and climate refugees, with a special focus on the Middle East. We'd like to acknowledge that today's topic may be challenging for those who've been affected by war, so we encourage our listeners to please take care. We've invited Cal State San Marcos history professor Ibrahim Almarashi to talk with us about this challenging topic. Professor Almarashi, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure.
We're excited to have you. Tell us about yourself, Professor Almarashi. What has motivated your area of study to include climate change?
So the history I work on is related to where my family comes from. So my father would have come from what is today Iran, but he was born and raised in Zanzibar. And Zanzibar, my grandfather, father was a cleric, so who, when he came to Zanzibar, his appeal was widespread because it was believed when he prayed, it rained. So already there, I grew up with stories about how my, you know, grandfather was able to, you know, relieve droughts on the island of Zanzibar. And of course, Zanzibar is a product of the monsoon winds, so that my father lived the life of the Indian Ocean. A lot of places that might disappear, what would encounter what a scholar named Joshua Busby said, state death, the Maldives, Seychelles, even Zanzibar itself, were stops on the way for my dad to visit India, where he did his undergrad. So the environment, humanity's relationship to the surroundings was a part of growing up, in this, you know, from the stories from my dad's side. On my mom's side, she comes from Iraq, and she would always tell me stories of the flooding of the two rivers. And so if I, you know, went and got my PhD wanting to learn about where I came from at the end of the day, I couldn't study the Indian Ocean in Zanzibar, nor could I study Iraq without an appreciation of how the environment shapes both those settings.
Oh, that's so interesting. Well, we're excited to dig into this.
Do you know the most famous Zanzibari?
I do not.
The most famous Zanzibari, his name is Farrokh Bulsara. Like my father, they both ended up having to move to the United Kingdom. To London, because Zanzibar was part of the British Empire. Farrokh Bulsara, when he was in London, changed his name to Freddie Mercury and established the band Queen. Now, when he says Bismillah in Bohemian Rhapsody, you might wonder, why is he saying the opening call to prayer in Arabic? Most likely, Freddie would have heard that call to prayer coming from my grandfather's mouth. My grandfather, who would make the call to prayer five times a day, would have said the word Bismillah. So I like to think it was from my grandfather's mouth to Freddie's ears to Bohemian Rhapsody. That's my connection to the group Queen.
Wow, my, that's so cool. Well, we're excited to dig into this. Conflict in the Middle East has lasted centuries, and this has led to migrations, generations living in warfare, and the exodus of an entire nation. Tell us a little bit about this.
Well, I mean, I like to think of, you know, the story of Abraham, who I'm named after. Ibrahim is the Arabic for Abraham. He came from what is today's Iraq, a town called Ur, and worked his way up the two rivers, the Euphrates and Tigris, and the land in between, and then reached the eastern, you know, towards the eastern Mediterranean. I like to consider him the first climate refugee. So, you know, in our conversation today, when I want to make the argument that we can affect climate action, it's by the words we use and the way we reframe these issues. So if you want to go back to millennia, from Abraham as a climate refugee, and then you have it in the Bible, people referred to as the sea peoples, were probably refugees in some way or the other, escaping some kind of, we don't know, volcanic eruption, crop collapse. Something happened with the environment. So you had this kind of confederation of peoples on the seas just attacking the Eastern Mediterranean, going to the very conflict right now occurring on the Eastern Mediterranean, where what's hidden behind the story was that these were, there were desperate populations approaching water bankruptcy, and what I would argue both Yemen and Gaza. And it's not an accident that you have two non-state actors, Hamas and the Houthis, who became violent non-state actors for a variety of political reasons, but we could also say political ecological reasons. Yemen was reaching water bankruptcy. The aquifers underneath the Gaza Strip were becoming so heavily salinated that when a population is thirsty, violence is one of the options that they turn to, or displacement. Whether it's the Dust Bowl during the Great Depression here, to the crises in the Middle East. This is the way the environment interacts with displacement and or violence.
Relative to that, you have mentioned what you refer to as hydroterrorism. Please explain this to our listeners. How has hydroterrorism and global warming caused severe water shortages in the Middle East?
So one way of thinking of the 21st century and one of the most vicious terrorist groups, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, I would argue we should call it the Islamic State of the Euphrates and Tigris. It makes a lot more sense because where ISIS spread was very much contained by the flow of the Euphrates and Tigris River. Their first capital, Raqqa, is in Syria. And that was a place that had a lot of displaced farmers who became displaced due to drought. And then preceding the drought, mismanaged water to cultivate cotton in Syria. Cotton is a very heavy, water-intensive crop. Then on the other level, you had a good number of militias on the southern confluence of the Euphrates and Tigris mobilized to fight ISIS. A good number of those militias were also displaced farmers, particularly of the marsh areas that were home to the biblical Garden of Eden. So there's always a hidden story of the way the environment intersects with conflict and cooperation.
Oh, that's interesting. We'd like to hear from you about the region's environment. Has ongoing conflict in the Middle East affected the region's agricultural productivity, things like soil and water contamination, and the infrastructure, in particular, the livelihoods of farming communities?
It's a vicious circle. The environment, when it's stressed, leads to displacement, and then those displaced peoples turn to violence, and then those people who take up violence then put further stresses on the environment. If we go back to the case of the Islamic State of the Euphrates and Tigris, what I argue is hydroterrorism is weaponizing water or kind of conducting an ecocide. So ISIS, when it controlled the Mosul Dam, the big fear was they would destroy the dam. And had they destroyed it, every city downstream, whether it's Mosul or Baghdad, would have been flooded. You would have talked about the death of millions of people. And then the other way you conduct hydroterrorism is when you control the dams, you deprive the downstream farmers of water, thus leading to their displacement. And that's something else that the Islamic State did. When they controlled some other dams on the Euphrates River, they would either prevent the water from flowing to the downstream neighbors, or when those militias I talked about started to approach ISIS positions, they would deliberately flood the areas, preventing them from, you know, conducting any military actions. So that kind of gives you an example of the intersection between environment and political violence.
How has this led to food insecurity?
Food insecurity is the product of not just political violence, but hydropolitics, the construction of dams. Here's just a very good example. With the construction of some upstream dams in Turkey, what has happened is the amount of water that now flows through the Euphrates and Tigris has been curtailed. And so as a result, when you have less water flowing and temperatures rising, you have more evaporation of these two rivers. And simply put, you have less water to irrigate. When water is starting to evaporate, you have lakes that start to dry up, and that exposes lake beds to the wind. And that creates dust storms. And now we get back to whether it's the dust storms in the U.S. in the 1930s or in Iraq. That all collectively leads to not only the displacement of farmers, less cultivation of food, the depletion of fish or cattle that depend on water. And that all collectively leads to food insecurity. And then finally, just very simply, we all need water to survive. And so you have now these issues that I never thought of talking about. Water justice. How do we guarantee equal access to those who are downstream rivers, whether we're talking about the Euphrates and Tigris or in Egypt, the Nile, which is currently being dammed in Ethiopia? You're going to have the same dynamic there.
How has the extreme weather caused by global warming and the resulting increased demand for electricity contributed to more violence in the region?
So you have both violence and tragedy. So when you talk about extreme weathers, we've witnessed, this is very fortuitous because we're witnessing extreme weather on the, American Eastern Seaboard. A couple of months earlier, we had Mediterranean hurricanes. These were unheard of in history, so much so that we developed a new name for them called Mediterranean hurricanes, which caused a dam to collapse in Libya, which resulted in the death of about 10,000 people overnight. So you have those kind of events. And then in terms of extreme weather leading to violence, it's this. ISIS and Al-Qaeda, they still exist, but they're primarily now spreading to sub-Saharan Africa. It's just when they, I want you to think, what's going to make more news? ISIS threatening to strike the Taylor Swift concert in Vienna? Or ISIS infiltrating a tribe that's fighting over water rights with another tribe allied to Al-Qaeda? Those tribes fighting over water in sub-Saharan Africa are not going to generate the news like ISIS threatening to attack the Taylor Swift concert. These are the kind of hidden stories of the way fluctuating temperature is leading to insecurity. It just doesn't necessarily always generate our attention.
Well, that's actually really sad to think about. Can you tell us how coastal ecosystems in Gaza have been impacted by both military activities and climate change, such as rising sea levels and pollution?
Well, sure, you have. The war and the fighting in Gaza, the conflict has been going on since, you could trace it back to 2008. And every single one of those conflicts lead to the targeting of, let's say, desalinization facilities, water treatment facilities, so that over the span of a decade, not only has Gaza's hydro infrastructure suffered, collectively rising sea waters, that leads to saltwater intrusions into, let's say, freshwater aquifers. You have to imagine, freshwater aquifers is where we get our water from. It's we need rain to replenish underwater reserves, reservoirs of water. And so in coastal areas, when you have saltwater intrusion, that makes the reservoirs, the aquifers, unfit for human consumption.
How can we fix that?
Well, on one level, you have to, if you're talking about in Gaza in particular, it's well beyond the crisis point, right? Right now, it just needs to be trucked in because you have so much displaced populations. But in this case, you fix it with investing in desalinization infrastructure, you rebuild fresh water, you encourage parties in the regions to create a just and equitable water network, an access to water. I mean, an access to water that is based on notions of hydrojustice, where access to water is equitable for everyone in the Eastern Mediterranean.
How does the environmental damage caused by warfare, like degraded air quality, intersect with climate change to create long-term damage to health?
There's a couple of things. So when we talk about long-term damage to health, we have to realize a lot of munitions that are deployed use depleted uranium. And that depleted uranium, it's valuable because it could penetrate, metal surfaces, making it a deadlier weapon, but it also results in those munitions more or less contaminating the area where it's being deployed. It's a huge problem in conflicts in the Middle East. It's a huge problem in Ukraine. Okay, so there you have the actual problem of warfare contaminating the environment. How does warfare, I wouldn't say warfare contributes to climate change. Of course, you have to realize with every, you know, ship that is mobilized for warfare that you are contributing, you're making a carbon footprint. The U.S. military, when it's deployed, makes a larger carbon footprint than some countries. Okay, so it's in those kind of ways that, you know, a carrier task force, when it's, you know, leaves San Diego Harbor and makes this long journey to the region, there's a carbon footprint. And then it happens in other ways you probably don't realize. If the Suez Canal is closed due to fighting in the Red Sea, ships have to make a longer journey across the Cape of Good Hope in Africa. Those longer journeys are resulting in greater carbon footprints. Those ships are just simply producing more fossil fuels in the air. So it's in these subtle ways that you have to, you know, make the connection to realize, you know, conflict does contribute to conflict in the sense that, or climate change, I should say. It's also happened historically. Whenever we scorched earth tactics, whenever we cut down a forest, you're depriving the earth of carbon sinks. So there has been this kind of long-term connection between climate and conflict and, you know, depletion of water or expelling carbon into the atmosphere.
Very interesting. Now we'd like to hear about the experience of climate refugees. Please share with our audience how the current conflict in Gaza and Israel intersects with climate change to aggravate the situation for refugees.
Well, so perhaps I could go back and say, if you look at the kind of long-term story, that the Syrian refugee crisis was intertwined with the management, with political ecology, the way the environment is managed, and droughts. Climate refugees, I mean, what's happening in Gaza is, it's not so much the story of climate refugees. These are internally displaced peoples because the border with Egypt is closed. So that makes them internally displaced peoples. In other words, these are peoples being displaced in a small strip of territory. Climate refugees probably might occur with the desertification that's happening in Iraq, in the Sahara. It's perhaps almost happening. We're just not connecting the dots that the mass movement of people through Libya towards Italy is related to failing crops, yields in sub-Saharan Africa. We're probably already seeing it. We just haven't called it out for what it is.
Relative to international peace efforts, what role does climate change play in calls for an end to the conflicts in the region?
I mean, I think it's just needed. I'm not sure if there's a direct correlation. I just think it's needed because we've forgotten climate change is a global issue now. It's put it off the agenda. And I think that's why, you know, a ceasefire is imperative. It's so that we could go back and focus the world's attention on the challenges and threats posed by climate change.
Right. What can be learned from past climate-related events in the region that could inform future conflict resolution efforts?
You know, there's you had the Conference of Parties 28 event in Abu Dhabi and United Arab Emirates. So that was the big you know, coming together of the nations to deal with the climate crisis. But what can be learned is that there hasn't been much done in the region. And there's also a real tragic reason for this. And it's for this. A good number of the economies in the region depend on fossil fuels, right? So in other words, what we have to recognize is the countries that are most dependent on fossil fuels are also going to be the countries most affected by climate change. And you have to have that realization and acknowledgement for any change in the region to happen.
Professor Al-Murashi, what can you tell us about people doing a climate action?
So some solutions are very easy. The first and most obvious is to vote this upcoming election, because this vote is going to determine the role of this nation in terms of addressing climate change like no other election I could think of. The other ways people can take action is to educate themselves. And one book I highly recommend that just came out is called The Heat and the Fury on the Front Lines of Climate Violence by Peter Schwarzstein, which I recommend. And then finally, talk about this issue with your friends. Use elements of popular culture to have this start off as, you know, conversations. One film I recommend watching is Don't Look Up on Netflix that came out. It's a good analogy for how, you know, we're just kind of blind to this issue. And the other two films that are the recent Dune series. The Dune series are very much good examples of using science fiction to generate debates and conversations on this issue. The desert planet that's known as Dune, Arrakis, was once a fertile planet until they abused the water. So I think you got to find ways to relate how to talk about these issues, raise awareness. And then once you have the awareness, then you can take action. And I think what taking action is, it could be anything from podcasts like this, which is a student initiative, to start introducing, change the language we use. You know, global warming was one term that was introduced to take actually our attention away from climate change, you see. It was to make us seem like it's just there's going to be global warming, and then later there might be global cooling. So we got to kind of reintroduce the way we talk about these issues. And, you know, one is talking about water justice or hydro justice. And just a very good example is south of the border, where, you know, not everyone has water justice like we do. In San Diego County, we have to address that. That water should be water justice, hydro justice should be a human right. The other way of thinking it, you mentioned all living things. And here's another way we have to change the conversation is this. You know, on the debate circuit, both candidates are going to be talking about national security. They might be talking about energy security. But we got to talk about security in the way that it's all living things, or what I call sentient security, is addressed. That whether it's plant life, wildlife, domesticated pets, or have some kind of security. Now, when I came to the epiphany of why we need to have a sentient security was the fact that, you know, during the presidential debate, one candidate more or less talked about immigrants eating cats and dogs. And I realized that not only was that just such a poor choice of talking points, but why is that tragic is the following. It is that there are cats and dogs dying in Ukraine as we speak, deliberately being shot there. In the current fighting in Gaza, there are, you know, domesticated animals as well as animals that are used, such as cows, so on and so forth, that are dying for lack of water. And so this is why I think instead of international security or national security, we need to start talking about sentient security, where all things in the environment, all living things, have some kind of way of being secured.
Well, thank you so much. Everybody, we heard it here first, what you can do for a climate action. Yeah. Yeah, of course, of course.
When we're speaking about education, and this is a level, this is a message for the administrators of the campus or the donors, is to offer classes on the environmental humanities. UC San Diego just passed a mandatory climate change class requirement. And I really think this should be happening at the California State campuses, definitely this campus, throughout all the campuses. And I do have to say the Cal State did have a good program, and I was part of it, where faculty members were part of a workshop on climate resilience, where how we professors can teach students how not to be despondent in our classes in the face of climate change. And so in my class on women in the Middle East, I talk about I talk about women in particular whose voices are usually suppressed in the Middle East, standing up and making a difference in terms of climate change. And that, you know, that should be a cause of optimism, climate optimism. And so I think that's ultimately what we have to do, is not just be despondent in the face of this, that, you know, realize in each and every one of our ways we can make a difference.
Okay, well, this has been fascinating, Professor Amarashi. I bet our listeners have gained a lot from what you've shared with us today. Thank you for talking with us and for your time.
Okay, excellent.
Thank you so much. Now this leads us straight to our call to climate action for this episode, and that is be water mindful. Water doesn't appear magically in your sinks. It takes electricity to get it to your home, so let's all be more water mindful. You can start with simple things like turning off the water when brushing your teeth and washing dishes. You can fill up a bowl or pot with soapy water for the dishes. These are just a few quick ideas to try out. Want to hear more from Climate to Action, a CSUSM student podcast? Listen wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on our socials at Climate to Action. That's at Climate to Action on Instagram, TikTok, and X. Visit for updates, behind-the-scenes content, and more. Finally, Climate to Action wants to remind you to take climate action. Be water mindful. Until next time, this is Climate to Action signing off.